Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Look, Mommy, squealed 4-year-old Leanne. I made water go down. I see. Her mom joined her daughter on the back steps, watching her use a series of plastic funnels and cups to catch the water from her red plastic bucket. Look at all the ways you're catching it, she replied. Yeah, but look at this, 8-year-old Ivan called to them both. This is really cool. They walked over to where Ivan was carefully placing a plastic water wheel and a series of plastic blocks and figures in a row. See, he explained, the garden hose makes the water drip onto the water wheel. Then the water from that knocks this block over and goes into that cup. But when it's full, it's supposed to knock over the Superman figure, who then falls into the dishpan. Great, huh? He beamed proudly. Very complicated, his mom nodded, smiling. Have you tried it yet? Some of it, admitted Ivan. I'm still figuring out where to put it all so everything works just right. It's a big job to do, his mom commiserated. Can I help too? Leanne pleaded, eyes wide with wonder. It's not for babies, you know, responded Ivan. I am not a baby, retorted Leanne, and I work too. From a parent's perspective, how can we stimulate our children's interest in science, no matter what their ages, outside of school? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has worked with kids and science for many years. Dr. Jerry Wheeler is the executive director of the National Science Teachers Association. A former science teacher, he taught high school physics, chemistry, and physical science, as well as college physics. Dr. Wheeler is the father of a 33-year-old son. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Wheeler.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Why is it important to offer kids science experiences outside of school?
Well, I think outside of school, there's more freedom to really let the child explore, to play, if you will. I mean, in school, we have so many constraints. They're important constraints. We have to have them. But outside of school is when we can, and especially parents, can allow the child to think through things. And it's the thinking process that's the most important part about science. It's not the vocabulary words. It's not the periodic table. It's how do you approach the real world. And if I can comment before you even ask on the story, if I had been that parent in that story, I would have been certainly as encouraging as that parent was, as that mother was, but I would have also then asked some questions. I would have said, what do you think will happen if you do this, as opposed to just saying, gee, that's nice, the water's flowing down. I would have been much more of a guide on the side and less a cheerleader on the side. Not that cheerleading's not important.
Good clue for us, then, as parents. It's good to ask questions.
It's good to ask questions. What you're basically trying to do, and it's awfully hard to say, it sounds sophomoric, is you're basically trying to help your child talk to the material world. You're basically trying to get your child to not ask you the question, but to ask the question of the blocks or of the flowing water or of the melting ice cube or something. You're basically trying to say, what do you think will happen, and then let the child go to the ice cube or go to the water play.
That's the hypothesis method, right?
I think so. I have a tendency to not worry about the scientific method. What I'm basically trying to do is get my child, or all children, to think more carefully and to ask the why question, but then also to be empowered to try to go answer the why question.
And speaking of empowerment, what kinds of activities are especially stimulating for really young kids? We had that little one in the story. What kinds of things can parents do for that age group?
The universe is open even at that age group. But, I mean, it is, as the example with that parent, it is water play. Water is a fascinating material. There's all sorts of different things you do. But with the very young children, you can do a lot with just talking about dealing with the properties. Why is water different from sand? What happens to water when you freeze it? What happens to the water when it went into the freezer? Will it come back? Can you make it go back to water? And those kinds of things. Getting to play with the idea that the material world has properties and that you can ask questions about those properties. Is it as big after it got frozen as it was when it was liquid? Again, I wouldn't stress the words liquid, but I would just try to get the child to think through some of those kinds of questions. It's easy with a young child. They're a scientist already. They're naturally a scientist. All you have to do is almost kind of get out of the way. But occasionally what you should do when you do get in the way, so to speak, it is to ask probing questions, try to set them thinking about it again.
I remember reading something years ago by John Holt, and he was talking about how children learn things, and he was saying that very often we do get in the way.
Yes.
Because I think his example was if we taught children to walk and talk the way we try to teach them facts of other things, they'd never learn.
They'd never walk, right? I remember one experience very early as a parent. When my child was in a playpen and putting these plastic eggs into a plastic egg carton. And the last one wasn't going in correctly. It was going inside, or correctly by my definition. And so I reached down and turned it so it would go in. All of a sudden, I got this stare, and the eggs were dumped out, and then the process was starting all over again. That time, the child's goal wasn't to fill the egg crate. The child's goal was experimenting with shapes and fits and stuff like that. And I had this idea of what they should be doing, and just not the same idea as what the learner is doing.
Great example.
And the other thing that I've heard over the years is a lot of endeavors, the arts and science, and a lot with when kids are young, it's the process, not the product.
It's much more the process. And I would even say that. I would stretch it probably a lot farther than most parents would. You never lose the process. You do pick up just because of the necessity of knowing certain facts and processes. You do pick up things as you head toward the older grades, but you should never lose the process.
You mentioned earlier the scientific method. Can elementary school children use the scientific method, and what kinds of activities can parents provide that help them grasp that?
The answer is yes, but with qualifiers. I mean, one of the challenges, Linda, is that you didn't mention it in my introduction, but I'm also a nuclear physicist. In research, I've never met the scientific method. I think it's a myth that we've created in schools. What the method is clear thinking, asking some questions, predicting some outcomes, testing some things. So that thing that we make children memorize, the five different steps of the scientific method, is just artificial. But going back to the spirit of your question, what we can do with our child is to get them to think creatively, get them to think critically, get them to do things to the material world, like freeze water or like blow a balloon up and let it go. But in the process of doing it, and you don't want to interrupt the play, but in the process of doing it, get them to think a little bit about what they think is going to happen. And in the process of doing that, then they can explore the times they're wrong. When they're wrong, there's five times more learning than when they're right. When they're right, they just move to the next thing. When they're wrong, it's, I wonder what I was thinking about. Why did I say that when, in fact, it did this other thing?
Parents need to recognize that, too.
Wrong is good.
Yeah. It's a tough lesson to learn as a parent.
I have a hard time learning myself.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on science for all kids outside of school.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Jerry Wheeler about science for kids outside of school. Now, what about middle schoolers? In my head, somehow, I have the picture of kids having a wonderful time dropping different objects from heights to sort of see how they fall and that kind of thing. But are there activities that parents can encourage for middle schoolers that would give them that same excitement?
Well, one of the things with the middle school is that they certainly want relevance and I guess authenticity is probably the 10-cent word. At that age, they don't want to feel that they're going through this kind of school-like kind of environment. So you really have to pick up on what they're interested in. And at the risk of being sexist, and I'm not, but the little boy that's interested in racing cars, then you go for that. Or the boy that's interested in cooking, you go for that. That's a chemistry experiment happening. And so whatever your child's interests are, try as much as possible to go for it. Now, generalizing over the cohort of middle-aged kids, they really care about their bodies. I mean, as parents, we all know that, you know, there's a lot of chemistry happening right there, a lot of hormones. So that if there's anything that has to do with nutrition, with health, and those kinds of things, then that's generally a pretty good opportunity. In the classroom, we call that a teachable moment. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it a teachable moment as a parent, but it's a rich moment to help them.
Are there any specific things that you could suggest?
Oh, gosh, there's 1,000, 10,000.
Well, two or three would be.
Well, one of them has to do with fitness and with any kind of the competitions. Let's say running the 100-yard dash. If the child's interested in a particular college or a professional sport, there's plenty of mathematics and statistics there. That's a little less easy to manipulate. But in their own running, for example, what's your heart rate when you're just standing here talking to me? How does that differ from your heart rate when you bring home a report card that has bad grades? How does that differ from your heart rate when you do 15 push-ups and then do your heart rate? And there's different kinds of things that just always exist. Even the melting ice cube one is not too childish for a middle level, but it's less interesting to the middle level. The middle level student's really into themselves, and you have to kind of meet them at that spot.
I wonder whether swim meets are good places, especially in the summertime. How long would it take to do a lap or whatever?
I remember once talking about my wife's aunt had the ability to float. From a science point of view, it was clearly she had a different density than most people. I mean, it's probably a more high fat, the muscle content, I'm not sure what, but clearly she could actually lie in the water. I mean, not lie flat, but float. She didn't have to swim. She could swim across the lake. She could tie, she stopped, and she's floating. And I remember talking about that at the dinner table. So the dinner table presents this conversation where something that's interesting, then play it up, talk about it. If you see something in the news that has some implication, a disease spreading, just talking about it. The parent doesn't have to be a scientist to think like a scientist. The parent doesn't have to be a scientist and know all the answers to have a good dinner time conversation about a particular disease spreading, about colds, about flu, about physical fitness.
I remember dinner time conversations about science projects. I have three sons, and we had a lot of science projects. But I have to tell you, their science projects were much more real science than mine when I was growing up.
Uh-huh.
I needed control. I wasn't going to take risk.
Uh-huh.
So I did projects on things like, how is paper made?
Sure.
There was no surprise.
Yeah,
there
not
was
much
nothing.
An experiment.
There was no failure.
More research. Yeah, it's
That's
research.
Right. I could do research, but my kids did things like, what kind of music do plants like best?
Sure.
And plants grew better with rock music in my house. And.
And it could have been the child was actually more excited and interesting. If Well, what I would have done there would have asked that kind of question. Was there any other reasons why that plant did better? There may be no other reason, but there's other things that happen when the rock music's playing.
Well, we had to rotate the plants in and out of a quiet room and play on the boombox the exact right music for the 20 minutes for each four plants and then bring them back to the other room. And if my kids went away for a weekend, guess who had to move the plants and play the music?
I did one with some seventh graders once. It was a lot of fun. And that was, I walked into the classroom with about six different paper towels that I'd taken the wrappings off so they didn't know which one. And I just said, which one's best? And we spent a day just talking about what we mean by best. Is it the best buy? Is it the most attractive? Is it the softest? At that time, it was Rosie the picker-upper ads. And so at that time, it was, is it the fastest picker-upper? Or is it the most picker-upper? And so any dinner-time conversation can turn into a nice series of experiments. I remember once with my son, they were talking about the setting of the sun changing location over time. And they were doing that in school. But I said, hey, let's try to do that here. And so he and I drew a picture of what it looked like from the back window. And then I went and Xeroxed that and made about 15 copies, and we dated them. And then he just recorded them. And sure enough, over the 15 days, he could see the sun's setting position changing. And so it was not a big thing. It's not a real science fair project. But it was something that he was mildly interested in at that time. He was interested in astronomy. It served my purpose, and it served his purpose for me to take advantage of that.
Now, if you have a child who insists he or she is really not interested in science, but faces a science project that is due on a certain date. How do you pique their interest?
Well, I'm not sure. I think the first thing I would do as a parent is, how do I get them going? And then trying to pick the project that might be the most interesting. But if they're starting out saying, oh, I don't really want to do this, then my approach, again, this is just my philosophy as a parent, has nothing to do with my science, is to just say, you know, that's not your choice. That's an assignment. So let's work and let's make the best of it. And then, of course, the Internet these days is a great resource. What kind of experiments are done? At the National Science Teachers Association, we have some stuff on our website, and we publish books that help teachers and children kind of figure out what kind of science experiments are generally done. How do you do them? And the biggest issue is to try to get them to do something that requires asking a question and then finding an answer. My wife used to give me a hard time about this because I'm kind of serious about science fairs. I think parents get too involved. And the reason my wife was giving me a hard time was I was so standoffish that I... but it is a delicate balance that you don't want to do the experiment for your child. And I see way too many science fair experiments where at least the display case, if not the whole experiment, shows much too much of adult interference. And I'm pretty sure it's not the teacher. That's probably one of the most difficult things that a parent has to face, is how to encourage, as you asked, Linda, without doing it for them. And my assistant has three young children, and she moans as soon as the kids come home and say there's a science fair project too. And so she picks my brain, and I try to not give her much. I try to get her to get on the Internet, and she does eventually.
It's interesting because when they are enthusiastic about a project, they will involve lots of people. One project that went on in my house – two sons did it in a number of years separating the times mm-hmm. it was done. They sat someone in the middle of the living room and played music, and you were blindfolded, mm-hmm. and you had to identify where the music mm-hmm. came from. And one of them won an award from Montgomery County.
Congratulations, mother.
Years and years and years ago. But it was interesting. The second one won the award. The first one came up with the original idea. Uh-huh. But everyone who walked in the house mm-hmm. had to participate in this because they needed a lot of subjects. Yeah. So that was kind of actually a fun thing. Mm-hmm. The work was being done by the kids, yeah. but it's an interesting.
That's a nice example.
Yeah. yeah.
Sometimes I would think things that kids are exposed to in the summer might also sort of drip over into something that will become a science fair project
sure.
later on in the year. And I was thinking about common things like you talked about plants or maybe rocks mm-hmm. or insects, that kind of thing, their summer habits, their fall habits mm-hmm. or whatever, but lots of things that kids can just sort of do around mm-hmm. and pay attention to.
My Boston accent aside, I live in Montana most of the time, and the wintertime mm-hmm. is also a very good opportunity for the snows are different, and there's different kinds of slipping and sliding experiments you can do. So there's a variety of things that every one of the seasons presents a new set of environments for your child to experience and therefore to think about.
What kinds of experiences are especially geared to groups of kids that would be welcome during the school vacation time?
Well, first let me say that I'm a strong supporter of group activity. I've done a couple different kinds of competitions with children where it was groups versus the single individual, the image you have of the science fair individual. And the big advantage of that is, at least in my experience, and it's supported a little bit with research, is that girls and minorities really resonate with group kinds of projects. That said, generally the ones that are good are those that involve some kind of team building and brainstorming. Brainstorming, obviously, is a lot more fun and a lot more productive mm-hmm. is more than one brain. And building's the same way. There's a competition that some schools have called the Science Olympiad, and they have different competitions within that. And the ones that are real popular are the ones where there's a team that builds something ahead of time, and then they compete. And the ones that are less popular, or at least arguably attracts the single individual science-oriented student. It's the kind of the spelling bee kind of, I mean, it's not spelling bee, but it's like the periodic table spelling bee, you know, name the chemical that has such and such. And those aren't as popular with girls and minorities, whereas the building ahead, competing from a group team is very popular. We have a competition at the National Science Teachers Association called Explorer Vision, and we've totally destroyed the English language with that one, but it basically means explore a vision. And we ask teams to think about a technology or an advancement in science 20 years out, something that doesn't exist now. But then we say, now explore that vision and tell us, why don't we have it now? What's the science missing? What's the technology missing? And then tell us what you think maybe the unintended consequences of that would if they do have. Well, these are usually teams of four, and we attract at least 20,000 kids each year to this competition. They play it out. They look in their community for resource. Some kids need a fireman. And so they'll call somebody from the police department or the fire department and ask questions. But that's an example of sort of, it's not really building there because that has to do with something that doesn't exist, but it's that group brainstorming.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on science for all kids outside of school.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Jerry Wheeler about science for all kids outside of school. What about the times when our kids have to be indoors and we'd like to find them some interesting things to do rather than whining, complaining, or getting on the electronic games?
Yeah, I've been there. You know, as a parent, I'm not sure I have many answers on that one because anything that I tried to find them to do didn't work. But if I tried to listen to them or what they're interested in, and actually, again, now I'm jumping to parenthood and less science, and I put limits on those games. and I put limits on television. But the child is welcome to sit there. I'm philosophizing, I should stop. My child is welcome to sit there and be bored. But generally, after a while, boredom loses out to doing something. If you've already provided that rich environment, then it's not a challenge or a question right there of coming up with something that will interest them, but it's they've got a rich storehouse of things that already interest them.
The other thing that we have always advocated is having materials around, not fancy materials, just materials that you know your child is interested in. That made me think of one of my sons who went into science in the end but was always interested in tinkering around with things. So anytime anything broke or I had extra wires, I would just sort of make a whole bin for him, and it had all kinds of commotion in it, but he really had a very good time with it.
I have close friends, parents that I went to graduate school with, and they have a four-year-old grandson, and he's got this big cardboard box with wires and plugs, and he knows he's been told and he behaves about not plugging into the wall socket. But other than that, everything, he's constantly making some arrangements, and there's somebody, as you say, Sandy, there's somebody that the environment's already there. And that doesn't mean that he doesn't have days when he's bored, but the environment's already there, and so that when he does get bored, he has places to go.
There are a lot of interesting things around that we throw away or recycle, like egg cartons, as you mentioned before, and shirt cardboards, the kinds of things that come into our homes that really need to be stashed someplace for those times.
Well, I have a commercial for the science teacher. Science teachers need all those things.
Sure they do.
We used to keep toilet paper rolls and paper towel rolls.
Yeah, right. And making string guitars or harmonicas, or there's a variety of things. And one of the things I remember once is, it was just kind of did you know kind of thing. And that caught my son's attention, just hooking a rubber band to his eye tooth and plucking at it. And the fact that a lot of your hearing goes through the bone in your jaw. It doesn't go in through your ear. And, oh, wow. Now, well, what happens when you pull it tighter? Oh, wow. What you're really trying to do is get a little bit of a wow factor in there. And then leave it alone. That's just an experience.
Yeah. That's funny. We have unfortunately been to many restaurants when my kids were growing up where I thought they were going to throw us out because they would get the water glasses together for the different levels of water.
That's right, yeah.
What resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to further pursue some of these issues and ideas?
I think the Internet is a good source. It's something that didn't exist when I was raising my child. But another thing to consider is, first of all, know your community. That most communities have a lot of things. If you're in Boston, there's the Children's Museum. But there's a variety of resources within your community that kind of would pique the interest of the child to do those. I was raising a child when we were in Philadelphia. So it was the Philadelphia Zoo and the Franklin Museum. And so that's probably the best resource to begin with because there's so much. It's such a rich experience. And again, going back to the Internet, just searching for science fairs or science experiments, there's thousands of books that exist on experiments. I remember one favorite one of mine, because I like to cook, was Science Experiments You Can Eat.
That sounds very good.
I don't think I have it anymore. I'm sure I gave it to some parent. It was fun, and I was getting into it. And that's another thing, that you have to actually enjoy it yourself as a parent. You can't be phony about it, because the child can see right through that. I mean, I'm perhaps more than my wife. I just enjoy those things, and so I kind of got into the book, and that it rubs off.
And I would think that summer vacations would be wonderful times.
Perfect time, yeah.
The beach or the mountains or riverside or anything like that. There's a wonderful story about a family that went camping near a dowel factory. And the children ended up with all the loose dowels, and they made things
for them. Oh, that'd be fun.
There's
the Crooked River Dowel Factory, and you could take all the ones that were no good for whatever the dowels were used for. You could have as much as you wanted. So we filled our station wagon with dowels and took them to the campsite.
That's exciting.
Kids had a great time.
And there was some museum, I think it was in New Hampshire, where, or maybe it wasn't a museum, it was some part of a factory that dealt with marble. Marble, and my children had a wonderful time bringing home lots of rocks.
That's a great example because it's not a science museum, and yet it's got materials. One of my passions is girls in science, and even your story that you read in the beginning, parents should think very carefully about how they're treating their daughters versus their sons, because even in your story, it was much more just encouraging the daughter, gee, that's nice, and then when it got to the son, and admittedly the son was older, so I'm not critiquing it too much, but when it got to the son, there were much more challenging questions. And I think especially for daddies with daughters that you have to be real careful you don't let your ego solve all the problems, that you, in fact, watch your language and watch your expectations and watch your activities with both your children, daughter or son.
Good point. My son is buying his almost 3-year-old princess dresses and those kinds of things because that's what she wants.
Sure.
But he is a scientist, and so let's hope that he shares that as well.
And there's nothing wrong with a child having that identity, but that doesn't mean the brain is different. The brain can still be interested in things.
Well, this has been a very interesting discussion, and we're sorry we can't continue it. Our time is running out. But Dr. Jerry Wheeler, thank you so much for being with us
today. My pleasure. It was fun.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 330. Spell anything that's not obvious if you can. That's very helpful to us. And tell us if you also can what station you're listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Today's program was made possible with generous support from the Evelyn Sachs Trust. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt. Mm-hmm.